Hello, welcome to NPR's On Science. I'm Christopher Joyce. Joe Palca usually joins me on these podcasts, but he's busy this week working on a couple of stories about Charles Darwin, whose birthday is coming up. Anyway, this past week, there's been a lot of buzz in Washington about climate change and green energy and green jobs. The Obama administration said it would put nearly 500,000 people to work with its new clean energy investments. And on Capitol Hill, lawmakers started thinking about the international climate talks that will be held in Copenhagen this year. Al Gore showed up at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee to put in his 2 cents worth. He's being called the Goracle now on Capitol Hill. But he's a welcome voice up there, apparently, because even Republicans were saying, "We agree with you, Al. We think we've got to do something." And given how much of the world's big emitters of greenhouse gases are willing to cut emissions, Al Gore says, well, maybe we will see something happen. Here he's talking to the Senate committee.
The very fact that developing countries like Brazil and Indonesia, China, which is in its own category, have now begun to take initiatives, I think that makes it a very different situation.
So Al Gore sounds a note of hopefulness here, but it comes at a time when we're hearing even more dismal news about the state of the planet's climate. According to a sobering new scientific study, climate change is becoming, in fact, is already irreversible. NPR's Richard Harris looked into this, and he's going to tell us why.
Susan Solomon is one of the world's top climate scientists, and the more she studies global warming, the more it becomes evident to her that this is not just another pollution problem.
We're used to thinking about pollution problems as things that we can fix. You know, smog, we just cut back and everything will be better later. Or haze, you know, it'll go away pretty quickly.
That's true for some of the gases that contribute to climate change, such as methane and nitrous oxide. But as Solomon and colleagues now show in a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, it's not true for the most abundant greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide.
People have imagined that if we stopped emitting carbon dioxide, that the climate change would go back to normal in maybe 100 years, 200 years. What we're showing here is that's not right. It's essentially an irreversible change that will last for more than 1,000 years.
That's because right now, the oceans are soaking up a lot of the planet's excess heat and a lot of the carbon dioxide we're putting into the air. Even assuming we could stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that would not solve the problem. Carbon dioxide will eventually start coming out of the ocean, and the heat will come out too, and that will take place for many hundreds of years. Solomon is a scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Her new study looked at the consequences of this long-term effect in terms of sea level rise and drought. If we continue with business as usual for just a few more decades, she says those emissions could be enough to create permanent dust bowl conditions in the U.S. Southwest and around the Mediterranean.
The sea level rise is a much slower thing, so it will take a long time to happen, but we will lock into it based on the peak level of CO2 that we reach in this century.
The idea that changes will be irreversible has consequences for how we should deal with climate change. We can't turn down the global thermostat once it's been turned up, so scientists say we need to proceed with more caution right now. Michael Oppenheimer is at Princeton University.
These are all, by the way, changes that are starting to happen in at least a minor way already. So the question becomes, where do we stop it? When does all this become dangerous?
The answer is sooner rather than later. Scientists have been trying to advise politicians about finding an acceptable level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The new study suggests that it's even more important to aim low. If we overshoot, the damage can't be easily undone. Oppenheimer feels more urgency than ever now to deal with climate change, but he says in the end, setting acceptable limits for carbon dioxide is a judgment call.
That's really a political decision because there's more at issue than just the science. It's the issue of what the science says plus what's feasible politically plus what's reasonable economically to do.
Now, it might be tempting to throw up your hands at this point and say, forget it. If changes are irreversible and emissions are already running out of control, the situation is hopeless. But Susan Solomon doesn't see it that way at all.
I guess if it's irreversible to me, it seems like all the more reason that you might want to do something about it, because committing to something that you can't back out of seems to me like a step that you'd want to take even more carefully than something that you thought you could reverse.
To her, that means stepping up action to prevent the situation from getting much worse than it is already. Richard Harris, NPR News.
So that story can't make everybody feel so great. But President Obama seems to be more optimistic, at least on what he can do and what the Congress can do for him. The president has long advocated a shift to greener kinds of energy, and this week he said that the energy provisions in his economic stimulus plan should start delivering, at the very least, some help to lower greenhouse emissions and a lot of jobs.
It will put 460,000 Americans to work with clean energy investments and double the capacity to generate alternative energy over the next 3 years. It will lay down 3,000 miles of transmission lines to deliver this energy to every corner of our country. It will save taxpayers $2 billion a year by making 75% of federal buildings more efficient. And it will save working families hundreds of dollars on their energy bills by weatherizing 2 million homes.
Green energy advocates have been anticipating this green spigot being opened, and the new energy plan certainly delivers tens of billions of dollars for solar and wind energy and power plants that run on farm waste and transmission lines to wheel those green electrons around the country. But Malcolm Wolf, who's the head of the Maryland Energy Administration, says it's actually the simpler stuff in the new plan that will create the jobs and juice up the economy now. Things like weatherizing homes.
The initial investment by having folks get trained to put in insulation, that pays dividends today because it employs people, and it pays dividends down the road because those homes therefore use less energy and are saving those families money.
Wolf says most states are already set up to help consumers weatherize their homes. He says in Maryland there are more people who want financial help to do this than he can pay for. The federal energy plan would boost his budget by at least a factor of 10. Making buildings more energy efficient is fairly quick and fairly easy. Wolf just weatherized his own home. It took a week and employed 4 people. The energy plan would theoretically multiply that by 2 million. But lack of cash is only part of what's been dogging the green energy business. The recession has hurt in unintended ways. For example, the government already gives sizable tax credits to solar developers. But Arno Harris, CEO of the solar company Recurrent Energy, says that's not helping a lot nowadays.
The challenge is that most developers don't have large tax bills, and thus they can't use the tax credits themselves. As a result, in order to finance the projects, they have to go find a bank or other partner with a large tax bill and basically put together a financing partnership.
That worked okay until the recession hit. Now, a lot of banks aren't as interested in a solar energy tax write-off as they used to be.
If you're a big bank and you've just lost many billions of dollars and you're not looking at a big tax bill at the end of the year, it doesn't make sense to invest in tax credits.
Harris says language in the new energy plan proposes to shift money straight to energy developers. Another problem in the past, one type of energy tax credit expired every year and had to be renewed by Congress. Investors couldn't plan ahead. Chris Fox is an analyst with Ceres, a green investment network.
That creates a boom and bust kind of environment, which, as you can imagine, it makes it difficult to scale these projects up when there's a start and stop.
Congress is considering language in its bill that would keep this tax credit provision but extend it for up to 3 years, which Fox says will encourage more private investment. Energy experts say spending cash now to weatherize homes and changing tax rules should work fast to stimulate the economy, but other provisions, such as building 3,000 miles of transmission lines to distribute solar and wind power, will take years to get going. And in the meantime, electricity from carbon-based fossil fuels, the ones that warm the planet's atmosphere, is still comparatively cheap. The energy plan doesn't deal directly with that. Chris Fox from the Ceres Investment Group says green investors would like to see that change, too.
Investors would like to see movement toward a carbon price, a mandatory national policy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions economy-wide.
Congress is expected to debate a price on carbon later this year. Okay, so we've had a lot of talk from scientists and politicians. Let's hear some squawk. From the west coast of Ireland, there is a rocky speck of land out there known as Great Blasket Island, and every year, thousands of Manx shearwaters gather there before their annual migration to South America. These ocean-going birds don't build nests, but they make burrows in the ground instead. As part of our series Sounds Wild, we're going to go to Great Blasket with Austa Bowen, who recorded the sound of these birds flying home to their burrows.
This is an extraordinary bird. The Manx shearwater, Puffinus puffinus, according to the local wisdom, only really call on misty and moonless nights. They're black or dark gray-brown, depends on the season, on top, and then they shade down to white underneath. The adults, by the way, are gone from the burrows and gone from the island throughout the daylight hours, and they only come back after dark. And so the chicks then are left essentially unattended all day, and the adults have been feeding presumably out on the water all day, and so they're bringing back their small fish that they've fished for and bringing those back to the young in the nest. At this point, I'm set up with the stereo mic pointed right into the burrows on a little tripod. And so the adult birds were landing and actually in some cases knocking into the mic and pushing it around on the tripod. And then some of the calls, the kind of squeaky calls, are perhaps the young in the burrows begging. There is something compelling about the shearwater. There are wailers and screechers and screamers, and it's a very electric sound. I felt like this was one of the highlights of my life.
Thanks to Austa Bowen for making this recording. It comes from the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Okay, we're back in Washington now. Back to policy, no more birds. President Obama, he's ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to review California's request to set tougher emission standards for cars and light trucks. And it does open the door to the possibility that cars and trucks for California, at least, and other states that are copying California, may be emitting a lot less greenhouse gases in the future. We'll hear this story from Elizabeth Shogren to explain how it all works.
President Obama says America has been dependent on foreign oil for too long.
It bankrolls dictators, pays for nuclear proliferation, and funds both sides of our struggle against terrorism.
And he says these urgent challenges are compounded by the long-term threat of climate change.
It falls on us to choose whether to risk the peril that comes with our current course or to seize the promise of energy independence. And for the sake of our security, our economy, and our planet, we must have the courage and commitment to change.
The president says that's why he's ordering the EPA to reconsider letting California cut greenhouse gas emissions from cars 30% by 2016. 13 other states have adopted California's standards, and others are moving in that direction. About half the nation's auto sales are in those states. The president also told the Department of Transportation to write new rules for national fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks. And he highlighted several steps that he plans to take as part of an economic stimulus package to reduce energy use. They include making federal buildings more energy efficient and doubling the capacity to create energy from alternative sources like wind within 3 years.
It will save working families hundreds of dollars on their energy bills by weatherizing 2 million homes.
Officials from California were delighted to hear Mr. Obama's announcement. In a statement, Senator Barbara Boxer said it was music to her ears. The auto industry has fought in federal and state courts to kill the California standard. Gloria Berquist from the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers says the auto industry is happy that the president did not say he would okay California's plan, but just said he'd review it.
It isn't written yet.
Berquist says California's program puts too heavy a burden on the industry at a time when it is laying off workers and closing plants. She says it opens the door for different requirements in each state.
What we're really looking for is one program and not multiple programs.
Car companies have supported tougher fuel efficiency standards Congress passed a year ago and hope they can be the basis of a new discussion with the administration. But environmental activists who attended the White House ceremony say the announcement is a clear signal that the new administration will approve California's plan. Michelle Robinson represents the Union of Concerned Scientists.
The important thing we heard today is that this administration is making a clean break from the last administration in saying that science should be behind good policy, not politics.
Later in the day at the State Department, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton named a new climate change envoy, Todd Stern. He'll help change the direction of the United States' international global warming policy. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, we've heard a lot about policy. We've heard yet more from scientists and politicians. Let's hear from animals again. One of the nice things about radio is that you get to hear the things that we write about and the people we talk to, not just us. And we've got a story here that's lovely for the ear, pardon the alliteration. It's about field biology in the ocean, and it's from a scientist who's turned into an independent radio producer, and his name is Ari Daniel Shapiro, and it's a story about killer whales.
I've spent part of my life as a killer whale biologist. I'm fascinated by both the whales and the lengths we go to study them.
Killer whales are great animals. They fascinate me a lot.
That's a friend of mine, Volker Dieke. He makes his living researching killer whales.
I love the challenge of having to think like a killer whale, you know, having to strip your biases as a terrestrial, visually based mammal, and now have to try and understand what life might be like for an animal that lives in a three-dimensional world where vision is not very useful, where sound travels for large distances.
I studied killer whales for my graduate work, so I get what it's like to imagine myself thinking and moving like a killer whale. In the field, I've had unbelievably vivid dreams of encountering the very whales I was hoping to find by day. Back home, I've heard emergency sirens outside and mistaken them for a band of roving killer whales that have somehow come ashore to put out a fire. Whales are mythic and real at once.
The one thing that I always notice about whales is people use them as a canvas, you know, the white whale. People just color them in and project whatever they want onto them. And the less you know about an animal, the more you can do that. You know, once you actually have the full knowledge of what the animal's about, it takes away that freedom to project your ideas into it, what it should be and what it should be doing.
So before we go any further, let's color in the killer whale a bit. They live in every ocean and hug the coastlines of every continent. Each population feeds on something different. In Norway, they eat fish, mostly herring. In Alaska, one of the populations eats marine mammals, including seals and porpoises. Killer whale feeding involves two basic phases. They locate and pursue their prey, and then they attack and eat it. In one very obvious way, killer whales that eat fish behave differently from those that eat marine mammals. These are the Norwegian fish eaters. They're loud. They call to one another a lot. They echolocate, using sound like an acoustic strobe light to scan their surroundings and find fish. Now here's a recording of the Alaskan mammal eaters in pursuit. They're absolutely silent. The seals and porpoises they eat have excellent hearing, and a vocal killer whale would tip them off and help them escape. So the killer whales keep quiet. But hearing in fish tends to be poor, so it's okay for killer whales to be chatty. It may be that they're informing one another of where they are, or maybe they're just excited. Both types of killer whales, those that eat fish and those that eat marine mammals, spend a lot of time in pursuit, waiting for and following their prey. And it's not unlike how killer whale researchers spend their time, waiting for the whales to show up, chatting with one another, scanning the water from a windy bluff.
I mean, you're just looking for little irregularities in the water. Anything vertical really sticks out in this horizontal landscape.
Volker is speaking from Fitful Head, a lookout in the south of the Shetland Islands, which are about 80 miles to the north of Scotland. I visited him and a field team of three this summer in Shetland, where they were studying the killer whales. One of the big questions was whether the Shetland whales eat fish or mammals. The team wanted to watch the animals in action, look for evidence of fish scales or marine mammal guts in the water, and listen for the presence or absence of killer whale vocal activity. But to get close enough, they first had to find them by spotting the animals from a distance. And that takes a lot of waiting. Here's Andy Foote, a killer whale biologist and one of the field team members, scanning the water for whales.
I think when you first get into working with whales, you almost jump at every wave or marker buoy, and then as you get a little bit more experienced, you sort of actually don't exclaim at, or have an outburst at the first sight. You wait for it to come up a second time, make sure, and you're like, oh, okay. Just that sense of excitement where all of a sudden the hairs on the back of your neck stand up a little bit, and then you've got your whale.
Day after day, while we stood there looking for whales and not seeing any, there were often tourists and locals observing us, trying to make out why we watched the waters around us so intently, so hopefully. Some folks understood what brought us there, like this fellow, Gordon.
When I was a kid, a teenager, we used to go bus spotting. Have you ever heard of that? We used to go around and take the numbers of the buses.
Oh, yeah.
And we had special books with all the buses in them and all the different types of buses, double-deckers, single-deckers. And we used to go in different garages and sit behind the wheel and rum, 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 you know?
That was your thing?
That was my thing.
So you can understand how you could get really interested in
something. I can understand how a person could be interested in a worm or a killer whale or a bird or whatever.
But some bystanders weren't quite so convinced, like Tom.
Could I do it? Not really.
How long would you wait up here?
Well, if I thought I was going to see one, I'd probably stay a half hour or an hour.
Would you stay here for 3 months?
No, 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 no. No, 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 thank you.
In 3 months, Volker Dieke's team followed killer whales in Shetland only 12 times. On average, that's a little less than once each week. But it's a start. They eventually observed whales targeting marine mammals, namely harbor seals, as prey. There was no evidence for feeding on fish, but the possibility can't be ruled out just yet. So they'll probably go back next summer to try to learn more. Volker's looking forward to it.
Having the time to immerse yourself into the place and just go beyond the first impression, I think, is a real privilege in itself, whales or no whales. That's certainly what keeps me going.
As killer whale biologists, we wait weeks for a glimpse of a black fin on light water, for the moment when we can observe and describe what the animals let us see. It takes a kind of love to maintain that kind of relationship, because we're pretty sure the killer whales don't feel the same way about us. It's not like they're waiting for us to show up, but it doesn't matter. We're drawn to them.
With killer whales, it's incredible.
That's field assistant Alice Rocco.
Like, the first time we saw them, to me, the male was extremely sensual, you know. Like, he had these sexy movements going on. It looks like he was a dancer or something, a really good dancer.
And it's not just we biologists that get infatuated. Killer whales are awesome creatures. Local Shetlander Derek Herning watches them from shore.
You get a thrill from seeing a killer whale. I mean, I know they're cruel, that they play around with the seals, they toss them up in the air and all the rest of it, but it's still a marvel of nature. It's a beautiful whale, the killer whale. So I take my hat off to it. I don't wear a hat, but never mind.
Killer whales capture the imagination, and maybe that's because of their very elusiveness. The way they disappear beneath the water's surface into their own world, leaving us behind on the shore, wishing to see them just once more. A love like that can sustain you for a lifetime.
This story was produced by former killer whale biologist turned public radio producer Ari Daniel Shapiro, with help from Jay Allison and the public radio website transom.org. To watch a video by Ari Daniel Shapiro of researchers conducting field work on killer whales, visit our website, npr.org. And one more thing. Do us a favor here at the Science Desk. We would like to know what you think about our podcasts, what you'd like to hear more of or less of. Just email our producer, Rebecca Davis, at NPR Science, that's all one word, at npr.org. NPR Science at npr.org. I'm Christopher Joyce. It's been good It'll be better next week, we hope. Bye.
Oh, well, in 5 years' time, we could be walking around a zoo with the sun shining down over me and you. And there'll be love in the bodies of the elephants too. And I'll put my hands over your eyes, but you'll peek through. And there'll be sun, sun, sun all over our bodies. And sun, sun, sun all down our necks. And there'll be sun, sun, sun all over our faces. And sun, sun, sun. So what the heck, 'cause I'll be laughing at all of yours.